Racing Australia, the official podcast of the Australian Police Journal.
Welcome to the podcast. I'm Jason Burns, and I'm joined by APJ Deputy Editor Barry Fay. G'day, Barry. It's great to catch up with you. How are you?
Very good, thank you.
Your article titled The Devil in Disguise is about a horrible crime in 1982.
Yes, a kidnapping story.
You started the article with a woman returning to her home on a weekday morning. Throughout the article, you've used the alias for her of Helen Jones.
Yes, she had just returned from a game of golf that morning. Her rich man's wife, although they were estranged at the time, got a phone call. It persistently rang two or three times, and finally she answered it. And the voice said, "This is the post office calling. We have a parcel for you. Are you going to be home today?" And the lady said, "Well, I'm going out later." Oh, he said, we'll be in that area. I'll call in anyway, and I have this parcel." She said, "Oh, okay." After she hung up, she was puzzled at who'd be sending her a parcel. She had a right to be puzzled because it wasn't the post office calling. He should have said, "This is the devil calling and I have a horrible experience lined up for you."
What happened next?
Only half an hour later or so, he turns up knocking on the door. Tall man, well-dressed. She had no worries about him. There was no more suspicions, although she should have been. Looked through a side window, saw the big, long parcel he had, cardboard box. She tapped on the glass and said, "Is that for me?" And he said, "Yes." So she came and opened the door. And as she did, he put his hand into the top of the long, tall box, pulled out a rifle, pushed it into her stomach and marched her into the house, demanding money. He's going to rob her. He pushed her up and she said, "I haven't got much money." She was she was estranged, just had enough to live on, although they lived on the North Shore. And he marched her up to the bedroom looking for a purse. And when he found that, all he got was $130. And then he threw her on the bed, jumped on top of her, dragged her hands behind her back and handcuffed her behind her back.
With proper handcuffs?
With proper handcuffs, yes.
Then what happened after that, mate?
Well, he said, "I'm going to get some money out of your husband." And it was like a sort of a revenge motive, but she couldn't work it out. Her husband was a millionaire, really, but they were estranged. He'd made money selling building supplies. Anyhow, he marched her down to the kitchen and then he said, "Wait a minute, you'll need a cardigan." She didn't know what he was talking about. He marched back, he found a cardigan on the bedroom cupboard, threw it at her, said, "Put that on." Then he marched her at gunpoint down to her car, her BMW, and pushed her onto the back seat, threw her cardigan over her head and tried to drive out. Had to do a three-point turn to get through their little access way that housed also the neighbours. Anyhow, at that time, one of the neighbours was coming home and he saw all this and he thought, "There's something wrong here. She always backs completely out. She doesn't turn around in our driveway like that. And there's a man driving a car, an unknown, a perfect stranger." And he saw something like a woman on the back seat, but he couldn't determine it with the cardigan over her head. Puzzled, he went inside and spoke to his father. He said, "Did you notice anything strange going on next door? I've just seen Mrs. Jones."
Before we talk more about what the neighbours did, can you talk about what happened to the poor victim?
Very sad problem. She's lying on the back seat with a cardigan half over her head, handcuffs behind her back, and she doesn't know where they're going, but they were driving along Forest Way on the North Shore towards a lot of bushland. There was a few acres of bushland along there, and his plan was to take her in there, which eventually he found a side track that he recalled, and he drove the BMW into the bush track, and about 300 metres or so in, he stopped the vehicle and got her out, still handcuffed. and pushed her ahead of him with the rifle pointed at her back. She was crying and protesting. "What are you going to do? Shoot me," she said. To which he said, "No, we're going to leave you here and your husband will find you and pay you some money." His plan was to kidnap the victim and get $500,000. Well, she was panicking. She said, "But I'm estranged. My husband and I haven't lived together for years. He may not care. Look, if you want money, ring my son. He's at this same number, same factory." And to which he said, "It's all right, I know what I'm doing." And he took her in, and then he found a suitable spot to tie her up. He put another rope around her legs and a small tree about the size of that you could get your arms around, all right. Then he took the handcuffs off her, and before she could even get some circulation back, he dragged her hands, grabbed them and dragged them behind the tree and handcuffed her again. So the poor soul was tightly handcuffed with her hands behind her back behind a tree. Then he gagged her, and then he tied her feet up. And then just before he left, she's pleading with him through the gag, "Don't leave me here, I'll die. My husband mightn't come. Ring my son. What's his name?" "Oh," he said, "John." And she said, "No, it's Ron. Ring him." Anyhow, just as he left, he pulled a pillowcase out of his back pocket and put it over her head, so she couldn't even see what was going on. After he'd left, about 10 minutes later, when she felt a little safer, she started to try and get the bonds away. By wriggling out of her shoes, she managed to kick the ropes down a bit and dragged her feet free. That was the first accomplishment. The next was the gag under the pillowcase. By using her skills, she dragged her mouth against the bark of the tree and loosened the gag. After that, she had to get the pillowcase off her head, and it was difficult. But she suddenly, in a squatting position, dragged her knees upwards until the pillowcase came off. And then she started to yell out, "Help, help," in that lonely piece of the forest.
It's amazing she was able to do that, and a great pity that no one heard her.
Yes, it is. But we got to remember this. This is midwinter. This is July 1982. The poor soul is in hundreds of yards in the bush, and night was falling. And she didn't know it, but rain was predicted in the middle of winter, and she's in a golf outfit. She'd just returned from golf before the phone call was made. Hadn't had a shower even.
Let's return to the house earlier in the day when the offender and the victim drove away. You mentioned one of the neighbours, a young man, saw the car drive off.
One of the closest neighbour saw a stranger driving his neighbour's car. And this is very unusual because she treated that like a god. She looked after that car. No one was allowed to drive it except her son occasionally backed it out. And he saw a woman he thought was on the back seat covered with the cardigan. But anyway, he went in and he said to his father, "Did you notice anything strange happening next door?" And his father said, "No, it heard nothing." And he's talking to his father about his suspicions. He went over and knocked on the door, called out a name, a few things, came back. His mother turned up then, and the whole three of them discussed the suspicions they had. Then they all went out of the house calling her name. And he found the back door slightly open, and he went in. He heard an alarm, and there was a phone ringing, and there was a heater left on. Well, this is not like Mrs. Jones. This is shocking. So they went back home and telephoned her son, Ron. Ron said, "I'll be on my way straight away home." And then after further discussions, they went to the police station to report it all. So fortunately, there was an early report. In the meantime, The son was talking to his father about a strange vehicle seen in the street, an old white panel van. And, of course, they didn't have any numbers or anything, but it was strange that this all happened. And it was still there. So the father and son checked this panel van out a bit. It had a vent at the top of the van, stood out like a lump.
So the neighbours went to the police?
Well, they went to the police and reported their suspicions, and the police turned up, took a few particulars, and looked around, asked a few questions to other neighbours, but nothing eventuated until the following morning. Now, by that time, her son Ron had came home. Ron was in the house when the phone rang about 8:20 in the morning, and a voice on the other line said, "I have your mother. I want $500,000 if you want to see her again." To which he said, "I haven't got that sort of money in the house. I'll have to get it out of the bank." Anyway, it went on, and he said, "I'll have to borrow it from my father. And banks are slow." Anyway, the police by this time were told about this phone call and immediately returned to the house and organised a phone tap. When the phone rang, when he called back, he wanted 50s and 20s. He was listened to by the police, who taped the conversation.
What happened then?
About 1:30 that afternoon on the second day, Ron picked up the phone, and so did his father on the extension, who was now aware of what was going on. And the offender demanded the money again, or else.
The offender also said he wanted to see police kept out of the matter.
Oh, yes, right from the start. And keep the police out of it. And the father said, "It's too late. It's already, the police have already been told, and it's your fault." He shut up after that, but kept demanding the money. And he said he wanted it in 50s and 20s. He was told that the time factor may be a day or so because he had to get it from the bank.
You wrote in the article the police spoke to a builder who had been working on the street on the day of the offence and had some information for them.
Yes, well, a canvass was immediately in progress because of the urgency of the matter. Kidnapping is a very serious crime, and they knocked on many doors. A few doors down, they met a builder who was helping other people who were away. Curiously, he said, "Yes, I think I can help you. I remember that vehicle, that white panel van. It was a Ford. It had a lump on the top of it, and I have part of the number plate." And it was a breakthrough. Never heard of before, a kidnapping, and they got part of a number plate. He said, "Yes, I just jot down numbers of number plates to see if I can marry them up with the owner." And he said, "In this case, I saw the letters JYP and some numbers, I think was about 600. And he said, "I immediately thought if the Y in the middle was put on the end, it would represent a famous singer, John Paul Young." Well, the police were overjoyed with this and rushed back and sent two detectives to the criminal investigation branch and the DMR to see what they could do. They didn't have...
What was the DMR?
Department of Main Roads. So at the DMR, they said, "Well, here's the three. Get print out the bloody letters, all the 1,000 numbers." And they said, "Well, we can't do that." They didn't in those days have them all computerised, but they could with a lengthy process with the crocodile paper, which had just A4 paper with the crocodile holes in it. They could print out over and over until they got it, and they did that. And then they took a shortcut. They asked what the other witnesses saw about the panel van and found out that it was a Ford and it was a van. And they kept eliminating everything else until they ended up with 6 vehicles.
Pretty good they could do that.
Yes, well, that's what police did in those days. And, of course, then they came to my office in the CIB with the criminal records, etc. And they said, "We've got 6 names. See if they got a criminal record." which was the right move, because out of the six, two are on record, one for drink driving and the other for criminal matters. Very cleverly eliminated 1,000 owners. They found out where he lived and rushed towards his residence to interview him.
Just teasing that one out a bit more, Barry, the suspect was a Glenn James Whiteley.
Yes, Glenn James Whiteley, alias Dawson. His record was quite extensive, and he fitted the description given by the people who'd seen him driving her car.
So the detectives raced to the suspect's house then?
They rushed off to Marrickville to check on the suspect and what he had to say about the matter. And they found him at home with the vehicle, the white van in the backyard, everything fitted. And they moved in and he answered the door. They started talking to him and telling him about the knowledge they had of his vehicle being seen near the kidnapping. Before very long, he confessed to taking her away and tying her up in a bush scene.
It's remarkable he made the admissions there and then, and very fortunate for the victim.
Oh, the victim couldn't have lasted much longer without food or water and her arms locked in that position. She had very little time left. And she'd already suffered some frightening things, such as spider webs being spun right near her, strange animals like wild dogs sniffing around her at night, and the freezing cold conditions where rain had sprinkled upon her. The only benefit she got was enough to wet her lips, and shivering all night.
And so the police went straight to the victim's location.
They took him with them, and he had to show them where he'd taken her, which he soon did. But it was pitch black in the bushland, but with torches flashing around, and the slamming of the doors aroused the poor woman, who was shivering and very near death. She cried out, and they heard her. So they yelled back, "Mrs. Jones, it's the police. Keep talking, we're coming towards you." And very soon after, they found her in that position. She had to be released from her handcuffs, but they didn't have any keys. The offender didn't have it on him. So they had a car that was used for drug raids, which had a bolt cutter on the back in the boot. And so they went and retrieved that and cut the handcuffs away. And as they did, she came towards the leading detective and said, "Detective, scratch me nose." She couldn't get her arms around the front to scratch her nose. So pitiful was the sight.
Although not violently assaulted, the victim nevertheless suffered quite a few injuries.
I believe rehabilitation took a couple of years before she could ever even think of playing golf again. It was a shocking way to torture somebody.
After the victim was rescued and taken to the hospital in an ambulance, the offender was taken to a police station.
To Chatswood Police Station for a record of interview, during which time he made certain admissions, including the fact that he had a girlfriend that worked for the company who was dismissed by the estranged husband of Mrs. Jones. The motive seemed to be one of revenge. But after he left her, tied up like that in that frightening condition, out of sight, out of mind, he went off to the movies. And the irony of it all was, the movie was called When a Stranger Calls.
He went to the movie with his girlfriend, didn't he?
Yes, yes. His unsuspecting girlfriend went to the movies with him that day.
One thing we haven't talked about is on the day of the kidnapping, after he tied the victim up to the tree, the offender returned a BMW to the street outside a house. Did he tell police why he did this?
Yes, well, he had to go and get his panel van And before he even went to the movies, he drove the BMW back right beside his panel van, and you could see that he was exchanging vehicles. And he climbed into his panel van and went back to Marrickville and left the green BMW in a place where his vehicle was, which surprised the neighbours, who by this time went to check on the van and found it that, oh, she might have returned. And they went knocking on the door again looking for the victim.
It's very odd behaviour. It's probably indicative of him not thinking through his plans.
Now, unfortunately, he was a very foolish criminal, but he just didn't have the knowledge or intelligence to see the errors he was making. Hence, the police were called when he's trying to tell them on the demand not to call the police.
He was charged with a series of serious offences, and the matters were dealt with fairly quickly.
He was charged with abduction, demand money with menaces, stealing a motor vehicle, stealing under false pretences, and other minor charges.
What happened in court?
It was a solid case, and they already had his admissions, and he pleaded guilty, mainly because even his fingerprints were found in the BMW. The evidence was overwhelming, and he was soon sentenced to 12 years penal servitude with an 8-year non-parole period.
I think it's fair to describe him as not being a model prisoner while in jail.
No, according to the prison records, he escaped twice and recaptured on both occasions, where he got an extension to his time to spend in jail.
The offender was eventually released in 1994 after spending a total of 13 years in jail. What happened to him then?
Well, apparently his criminal mind was still very active, and he started searching for a means for an easy robbery, abduction, anything that might give him a dollar. He came across an antique shop at Dural with a lone woman serving, which he immediately planned to rob, as there'd be a lot of money there. Little did he know it, but this antique shop had been robbed before, and an alarm was set up between the woman and her husband, who had a rifle in the back shed. And on the day in question, he came in, had cut another rifle down to a shortened size, pulled it out of his shirt, pointed it at the woman, and demanded money. Little did he know it, but she pressed the alarm button straight away. There was another woman being served in the shop too, who was fearful of the event. But as he dashed out with a bag full of money, the husband was right behind him, he gave chase until they faced each other, one with the sawn-off rifle and the other with a proper rifle, and he aimed it deliberately at the owner, who shot first and fatally wounded the man. Poetic justice.
Summing up, Barry, what are your thoughts about the case overall?
In summation, the case was amazingly full of incidents that proved a very quick release for the victim, a victim that would suffer for years to come, a horrifying experience, and yet through a coincidence of good material, a good investigative work, and being able to interview the suspect without a warrant, led to her early release. She wouldn't have lasted much longer. So the whole story is very good police work in a nutshell.
I think it's also a great example of neighbours keeping an eye out for each other.
Very much so, especially as the neighbours caused the early investigation. They'd spotted the offender's vehicle. He was such a fool in what he did. And then the unbelievable breakthrough that somebody had most of his number plates. In the long run, even of the list of 1,000 cars, there were only 6 to investigate.
Barry, how did you come across the story and decide to write about it?
Well, I knew Detective Hodgkinson. I did a murder inquiry with him in my fingerprint work years ago. Somehow or other, he mentioned this to me. I immediately got interested, especially with all the seemingly miracles that happened to bring about the poor woman's release. And that's what the story's all about, the suffering by innocent people. He never knew her. And here she was, suffering like that for almost 3 days.
Thank you, Barry. I appreciate your time today.
No trouble, no trouble.
That was Barry Fay, Deputy Editor of the Australian Police Journal, talking about his article, The Devil in Disguise. You would have also heard at times some boisterous birds, which I suspect were lorikeets. We recorded the interview at Barry's home, and his suburb is blessed with plenty of native birds. The Devil in Disguise appeared in the June 2006 issue of the APJ. Subscribers can read the article in full, as well as almost 300 back copies of the journal, online at apjl.com.au. Check out the website to see the full range of issues, stories and podcasts. You can also purchase an APJ Challenge coin. On behalf of the APJ team, I wish you a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year's period and a safe 2023. Until next time, take care.